Welcome to History's Nightfall podcast. I'm Dan Jones, author, broadcaster, and historical consultant on Nightfall. And with the cast and crew, I'm here to delve into the medieval world that Nightfall creates, and quite frequently blows up with fireballs and siege catapults. Now, obligatory warning, there are spoilers ahead. So if you don't want to find out that Landry and Denogre are secretly brothers, and the Pope is their dad, don't worry, I'm joking. Just make sure you've caught up with the fifth episode, episode 5 of Nightfall. Make sure you caught up with it before you continue. Okay, in this episode of the podcast, I'll be speaking to Lords Faberis, who plays new character Altani. And we'll have showrunner Dominic Minghella on the line, who I want to ask about how TV writers juggle fiction alongside fact when they're trying to tell a historical story. But first, we've just seen a spectacular episode 5 of Nightfall, so let's catch up on what happened. It's Isabella's wedding day. Like any young girl about to get hitched, she's excited, and just like any good wedding, there's probably going to be a fight. In fact, no, there's definitely going to be a fight. For one thing, King Philip is going to attack England because he's sore about a horse that got decapitated. And for another thing, someone has taken the liberty of sprinkling something all over the royal palace.
Greek fire.
Yes, Philip, Greek fire. It sounds like an unpleasant aftershave, but it's going to give you more than just a rash on your neck. Now, while all that's going on, Landry and the Queen, who I'm now calling the Ross and Rachel of the early 14th century, are back together.
I will have the
except
king's
they're not.
Child.
Or are they?
And you will go back to the temple. That is our future.
Okay, fine, they're not. Over at the temple, meanwhile, Tancred isn't getting off lightly now he's confessed to killing the mysterious Saracen prisoner. And something of a departure from the official penances prescribed in the real rule of the Templars, Landry has organised for his friend to be chained to a cross and punched in the face repeatedly by all his Templar brothers. Well, that's not exactly brotherly, is it? But Tancred only has to say sorry, and it'll all be over. Will he do it?
I do not repent!
I'll take that as a no. Back at the palace, Denogre has had too much to drink. Too much poison, actually. But who's poisoned him? Could it be...
Let it work.
Exactly as you planned.
That is a dastardly plot, all right. And it ends with poor old Luis being flash-fried in a medieval car chase. So after all of that, it turns out there wasn't a wedding after all. And the actual history of France is more or less back where it should be. Which is good, because personally, I was starting to get a bit nervous. Now, there's so much to talk about in this episode, both in terms of history and Nightfall's own Templar mythology. But I want to begin with two words that rightly strike fear into the heart of everyone throughout the show. I'm talking about...
Greek fire.
In episode 5, Gawain and Parsifal find two chests full of the stuff. So let's hear Gawain explain how it works.
The smallest spark sets it aflame and it engulfs everything it touches.
It sticks like honey to the skin and peels it off in the blink of an eye. Water will not douse it. It is a wicked weapon. They call it Greek fire.
Now, I don't know of any record that has Greek fire really being lashed all over the French royal palace in 1306, but Greek fire itself was well known in this period, and particularly to crusaders. It had been seen firsthand, in fact, by Philip's grandfather, the Crusader king and saint Louis IX, who led a massive assault on the Egyptian sultan in the Nile Delta, about 60 years before the events in Nightfall take place. Now, in the account of one of those battles that Louis IX fought, we learn that the French crusaders were terrified when their enemies loaded Greek fire-laced missiles onto their catapults, because when it flew through the sky, it apparently looked like a dragon attacking them. In fact, each time Greek fire flew overhead, Louis IX would throw himself to the ground and start weeping and praying. So with that in mind, we can at least imagine that Philip IV would have heard of it. Hence,
Greek fire.
So far as academics today have worked it out, Greek fire was a naphtha-based resin Now, put simply, that means it was made from a combination of flammable oils. It had been in use for centuries, and it took its name from its supposed use by sailors from the Byzantine or Greek Empire, who'd found a way to pump it at enemy ships out of what amount to medieval flamethrowers. Greek Fire's association with the Crusades and the Wars of the East is probably why the Nightfall writers decided to have its use controlled by our mysterious character Al-Tani, a shadowy assassin from the East who sort of clambers down chimneys like the Christmas Krampus. And it's such an explosive toy for screenwriters to play with, I mean that literally, that you can also see why they built a whole non-historical wedding and chariot chase around it. But of course, all that raises one obvious criticism, which is that although Greek Fire is great fun, its place in this story takes us quite a way away from the known events of the French court in 1306. I thought it was important that we heard from the show's creative team about this whole business of mashing up history and fiction.
Hello.
Dominic, it's Dan. I called Dominic Minghella and asked him to explain.
Your principal job is to entertain and get people, as you say, to come back week to week. So you have to spin a yarn, you have to tell a story, and it has to obey the rules of the day. And so if there's good history to be enjoyed along the way, then the kind of duty is to be respectful of that and do that. But I think with the best of intentions, what happens is you put a helmet on somebody and you can't see their face, or it just looks a little bit silly, and it's the accurate one, and you think, well, actually, let's go with this other one that could just have been, you know, was 50 years down the line, they did have helmets like that, so we'll do that. But actually, the guiding principle is, does it kind of look right, or is it going to get in the way of the flow of the story and stop you doing your job, which is to tell a story? And you just have to plot your course through it and pray.
spoken like a good Templar. And I was certainly surprised, having never worked on a TV drama before, the level of detailed thought that goes into those decisions. And I think the first conversation you and I ever had was on the phone, much like this, but it was about the shape of the Templar's cross and the pattern that would be on the shield, whether it should be black and white, as we see in a lot of representations of the Templars, and whether that would mean anything to a viewer coming to a show about the Templars for the first time, or whether we should have these shields that were white with a T-shaped classic to us today Christian cross. You put a lot of thought into those kind of decisions, don't you?
Yeah, you do. And there's lots of long conversations about, and that's obviously design and production design and costume design, how will that decision on a flag carry over into a decision about costume, and literally putting people inside costumes to see what it's going to look like. And that, a lot of that, there's academic conversation about it, but a lot of it in the end is about the aesthetic. And we tried to create a kind of holistic world in which the brand was quite strong of the Templars. And bearing in mind that as the series develops into further seasons, that you might want to bring in, their Hospitaller relatives, or indeed Templars from elsewhere. And to be able to ring the changes between our Paris gang and Templars from elsewhere in Europe. And, so I suppose we were thinking about that. And, of course, where you come a cropper is where, if you're designing a cross into an architectural feature, it works by and large so much better if it's more Celtic, if it's got those sort of serifed edges and is more squat. That goes against the sort of the overall decision that we made. But I think we went, we followed our... We talked a lot intellectually, but in the end, we followed our noses there.
Dominic was talking generally there about the decisions a showrunner makes between creating a gripping story and staying true to the aesthetic of the show. And actually what he says makes a lot of sense. Historians are often great at criticising TV shows for the things they get wrong. But if there's one thing that working with the team on Nightfall taught me, it's that even when history is ignored or reworked or even, now and again, trampled all over, it's never done unthinkingly. And the measure of what comes out at the end is, in my mind, pretty simple. Was that an awesome TV show? And will I watch it again next week? Now, I should also say here, because I can, that if you want a good book on real Templar history, then The Templars by Dan Jones... I can't do that? My producer's making angry faces through the glass. OK, we're going to move on. Let's turn to a new character on the show who, for me, is a great example of what Dominic was talking about earlier, and that's Al Tani. I can remember having a pretty robust exchange with the writers' room when they were creating this character. It started when I got an email from one of the lead writers asking me to rate the plausibility of there being, and I quote, a black female Muslim assassin living in Paris in 1306. Now, obviously, that's not who the finished character of Al Tani became. In fact, she's a female Mongol assassin living in Paris in 1306, and that's still pretty spicy, but it's certainly more plausible, because there had been diplomatic exchanges for decades between French kings and the Mongol Khans of Persia. Both of them wanted to gang up on the Mamluks and carve up the Holy Land between them. And Templars had planned joint assaults with Mongol lords in 1300 to 1302, so historically we're not coming completely out of the left field. But what made Al Tani really credible for me was the actor that Dominic and the show's producers cast to play her. She's called Lord Sferberis, and to say she threw herself into creating Al Tani as a rounded, historically possible individual is, well, it's an understatement. Here's Lourdes explaining who Al Tani is.
She was a Mongol assassin that the Templars had kind of encountered in a past battle for the Saracens. No one knew her name. They knew of this Mongol who was very skilled in not only fighting in weaponry, but in poisons and chemical warfare, and that this thing called Greek fire. Which is like she knew how to manipulate chemicals so that it would spew fire that no one could put out. And if you try and douse it with water, it would just spread like gremlins. They did fight at one point side by side, the Mongols and the Templars. And so there was that encounter, which was historically apparently accurate. And the fact that assassins as well, by nature, they operate alone, and hence they can weave in and out of societies, and they can blend and be in the background until their point of attack. And the reason why I really like this character is because she does, no one knows who he, she is, because they all think he's a man, because the assassin parades around in a mask and he's cloaked, and you know, no one would think that someone capable of such things at that time was a woman.
You've clearly done, created a sort of backstory for this character.
Yeah.
I think the first time I met you on set in Barrandov, you told me that Al Tani was the granddaughter of Genghis Khan. Is that true?
Well, she was one of the daughters of Genghis Khan.
Really?
From one of the wives, not the first one. And basically, she was famed... because in Mongol societies back then and now, there was actually very forward-thinking gender equality. If you can shoot and hunt and show warrior skills, whatever your gender you're in, you know, you're seen with equanimity in that society. Anyway, she was one of the daughters of Genghis Khan, and at one point in her, I don't know, early teens, she ended up saving the youngest son from the first wife, so i.e. one of the heirs, from some Tatars, some bandits that were wanting to kidnap him.
I've never heard all this before. Oh. This is amazing. But is this your backstory, or is this a backstory that was created? It's not in any of the scripts. Where's it come from?
Yeah, so this is what I'm saying to you right now. It's still stuff things I researched. Ah. And then from the point of when she became a warrior and she was married off to someone else, to an adopted son in her mother's tent, as you do. And then he dies. And so from that point on, I take it, I made it up in my head how she came to be in Paris, which is that, you know, with the skill she had, she needed to be doing things that were expected of women. And so she left, because sometimes you just want to go.
A quite amazing amount of detail there from Lourdes. Now, I have to say, I've got my issues with her theory that Altani was a daughter of Genghis Khan, the founding warlord of the Mongol Empire, who conquered about half the known world in the 13th century, mostly because Genghis died in 1227, which would make Altani at least 79 years old in 1306. But I think we'll give her a pass for that, because in every other department, her historical backstory gets an A triple plus. OK, so we're coming towards the end of the episode now. And for the whole series, I've been meaning to talk about one more thing that's been really twisting my brain about Nightfall, and that is the oranges. At least three times in the series, we've seen an orange pop up. It's there in episode 1.
I had to go.
And then again in episode 4, after Landry takes a trip in the pagan hut. It turns up again at the top of episode 5, so I think we owe it to ourselves to try and work out what on earth this thing is. Now, obviously, it's an orange, and it looks like it has something to do with the Brotherhood of Light, who are a creation of the show's writers, so I suppose they can do whatever they like with it. But the question in my mind is, I suppose, why an orange? It struck me that the best person to ask about this was the man we last saw in possession of it. So here he is, Mr. Tom Cullen, trying his level best to put my mind at ease. Why do the Brotherhood of Light use oranges to communicate? Would there not have been a more convenient way than the orange, which as an exotic fruit would have to be imported from quite some distance to northern France?
I had a line which was, luckily I had some ADR, which was, my master was called by an orange. And I couldn't help thinking that there was some giant orange sat masterminding this whole thing, just calling people.
Like James and the Giant Peach sort of dropped in his garden.
Exactly. Hey, I'm the orange around here. Now, I want you to go and speak to Landry. Landry, I want you to go and go here. That's what I had in my head. I think that's why we've got oranges. I have absolutely no idea. I have no idea. It's a distinctive colour in a murky world of grey, brown, and filth. A singular orange pings out and will catch your eye.
In a murky world, the colour of the orange pings out. Tom Cullen on his finest poetic form there. And I guess the answer is that the point of an orange is that it's orange. Sometimes it's best just not to wonder too hard. OK, time for your questions. And today's come from someone on Twitter called Cole Goodenough, which could be a real name, although I'm slightly worried it's a pun I don't understand. Anyway, Cole wants to know why the crosses on our Nightfall Templar's surcoats are large and cover the whole chest, whereas, says Cole, in the Middle Ages, most Templars' crosses were, and I quote, small and on the left breast, which was thought to be where the heart was. Now, in a way, that touches on a lot of what we've spoken about today, but I think there's actually a lot more we could still say about it, so at some point before the end of this podcast series, I'm going to get to the bottom of it. In fact, I think the best person to answer that question will be director and executive producer Douglas McKinnon. So, Cole, your wish is our command. OK, while I set the researcher gremlins on tracking down Douglas, I want more questions. So if you have something to ask about the show, then search for Nightfall or History on Facebook and Twitter, or tweet me at DG Jones using the Nightfall hashtag, and I'll do my best to address the questions here. Next time, we'll be talking torture. Thanks for listening. History's Nightfall podcast is presented by Dan Jones and produced by Sam Pearson for A&E Networks.